Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And the tumultuous day in the Middle East that you've been hearing about on the BBC and the takeaway this morning signal another tumultuous week in the United States. So much Trump foreign policy news right now between the Iran arms deal, the pending North Korea summit, Trump helping a Chinese tech giant who he hurt just last week. And then there's Russia. The Russia investigation under Mueller turns 1 year old this week, and that's going to make for some fireworks based on all indications. And our first guest this tumultuous week is Washington Post columnist Karen Tumulty. Hi, Karen. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be here.
And we'll be talking more, listeners, about Israel later today with former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who will be a guest on the show. And for something completely different, we will have New York Mets broadcaster Keith Hernandez later as well. But Karen, right now, what are you hearing from Israel, and what is the administration hoping comes from this?
Well, I think that there are two levels of calculations going on here, one of which is, cementing the close ties with the government of Bibi Netanyahu in Israel. But I think this is also very much got a domestic U.S. political component, and that this is a promise that President Trump made on the campaign. His son-in-law, Jared Kushner, highlighted that, emphasized that very much in the speech he gave just a few moments ago. So essentially, this is the president asserting that he is following through on a promise. This is something, of course, that makes us virtually unique in the world. I think there's only one other country, Guatemala, that has its embassy in Jerusalem. And it is something that has added additional strain to our relations with the European allies. But it was something that the president felt very strongly that he wanted to do.
I think I read Guatemala and Paraguay. So that's an interesting coalition of the willing, the United States, and Trump doesn't even want people from Guatemala in this country. But Guatemala and Paraguay and the United States as the only ones who are moving their embassies to Jerusalem at this point. The delegation arrived yesterday, and it includes Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, as well as Jared and Ivanka and people like the U.S. Ambassador. What's Treasury Secretary Mnuchin's role in all this?
Well, I think Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, I think this is, he is a very prominent Jewish member of the cabinet. And beyond that, I don't know specifically why you would send a Treasury Secretary for this sort of event. And beyond that, you do have a pretty large congressional delegation there as well.
Round up the Jews and show face is what it sounds like. Not to mention the Jew in charge of the money, Steve Mnuchin. That's a great signal to the world. Kushner met with Netanyahu, I see, to talk about Mideast peace, quote unquote, on Saturday. Any word on how that went?
Well, I think we see how that is going in the streets, where there has been a lot of violence over this. And I think the general presumption analysis of all this is that it's going to make finding peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians more difficult, not less.
Last week saw yet another leak from the White House, this time that an aide joked that John McCain would die soon, when they were talking about his opposition to CIA director nominee Gina Haspel, because she was involved in the torture program in the Bush administration that McCain objected to. And then there was this leak, as I say, from a White House communications person or of something that she said in the meeting, oh, it doesn't matter, he's going to die soon anyway. And I see that you've gotten into a Twitter back and forth with a conservative Fox News commentator, Britt Hume, over the importance of the leak versus the importance of what she said. Can you characterize your own Twitter exchange right now?
Sure. The White House has not apologized for this this appalling and indecent comment that was made by one of its aides. And what they have denounced is the fact that someone in the meeting leaked it. So Brit Hume of Fox was also commenting on how White House leaks are, you know, not a healthy thing to have in a White House. And my comment back to him was that some White Houses leak a whole lot more than other ones do, and often that is a reflection of the insecurity of the individuals within that White House. It was interesting that not only did the comment itself leak, but then the meeting that Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, had to chastise the staff for leaking, that leaked too. So I think what you see are a lot of people within this White House who are not all that sure of their own positions, especially with this president. And they increasingly, even as this White House denounces the media, this is how people, more than most White Houses, I must say, sort of air their disagreements, is through leaks to the media. And I think it speaks to a basic, as a member of the media, I think, you know, we're all for leaking, but I think it does speak to a basic dysfunction within the White House.
How do you explain it in this case? We know that Trump is ferocious in public when it comes to the question of leaks, especially leaks from other institutions other than his own White House staff that leak things that are damaging to him. Like, we've learned so much about his contacts with Russia that obviously didn't come from him. Maybe some of those things did come from his inner circle because of inside sniping. It's hard to tell. But in this case, it's something that seems to directly undermine the president's position with respect to Gina Haspel. And it comes from within. It doesn't seem like it came from John McCain's camp or it came from the Democrats' camp. It kind of would have had to come from within because of the limited number of people who were in that room. How does that even make sense? Who would do that for what? For what reason?
That is really unclear. And it also could be that somebody on the staff is essentially trying to kneecap somebody else on the staff. We don't know if this is about policy or if this is about decency or if this is about some kind of interpersonal dynamic that we really don't know anything about.
Listeners, our phones are open for Washington Post columnist Karen Tumulty on any of the things in national politics right now, the Mideast, other foreign policy, John McCain, Gina Haspel, Brit Hume, Karen, and the White House leaks, or anything else. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I want to go on to your most recent column, which is something that we discussed briefly on Friday's show with the mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio. You wrote up White House Chief of Staff General Kelly's comments from last week about why he doesn't want a lot of people from Mexico immigrating to the United States. And he says it's not because they're rapists and drug dealers, as someone he knows once suggested, but it's more about how assimilable they are into American life. Here's 26 seconds of Kelly.
Let me step back and tell you that the vast majority of the people that move illegally into the United States are not bad people. They're not criminals. They're not MS-13. But they're also not people that would easily assimilate into the United States. They're overwhelmingly rural people. In the countries they come from, fourth, fifth, sixth grade educations are kind of the norm. They're coming here for a reason, and I sympathize with the reason. But the laws are the laws.
So that was on NPR last week. You said his comments were especially egregious because of his name, Kelly. Want to explain?
Yes, I say this as someone whose last name is Tumulty, so I think we share a bit of heritage here. First of all, let me say that I think no one disputes that the country, you know, has a right to control who gets to be an American. But to set as the criteria, you know, we don't want people who come from rural backgrounds who don't have a lot of education, suggests that the White House Chief of Staff, Kelly, forgets a lot about how the Irish were treated when they got to this country in the huge waves in the 1850s. There was a famine underway back in Ireland. A lot of them came from rural areas with little education. They arrived, they had gotten together enough money to get on the boat on the way over, but a lot of them arrived with almost nothing else. At one point in the 1850s, 70% of all the charity in New York City was to Irish people. And they also suffered bigotry based on their religion. And they were, you know, very much viewed the way that General Kelly was suggesting he views, you know, immigrants who are coming here now. And they assimilated just fine. So I think that, again, I mean, these are often people who are going to be the, you know, the strivers, the people who really bring greatness to our country.
Let's take a phone call. Peter, well, actually, before we do that, just to stay on Kelly for a minute, you tied his let's give our listeners a history lesson. You tied his comments to the Know Nothing Party of the 19th century. You want to give our listeners a little more of a quick U.S. history lesson on that? What were the Know Nothings, and how are they relevant to this?
Well, they actually started as a secret society, and if anybody was to ask them about their, you know, what they were up to, they were to say, "I know nothing." But ultimately, they and in part, in large part, because of the backlash to Irish immigration, they turned into a political party. And we are not talking about just a fringe political party. You know, there were over 100 members of Congress who were members of the Know Nothing Party. And essentially, if you look at all the things they stood for, including, you know, expelling Catholics from this country, and returning the country to its Protestant values. I mean, they were the Make America Great Againers of their day.
Now let's take a phone call from Peter in Norwalk. Peter, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you, Brian, for taking my call. So I am not a Trump supporter by any stretch, but I hope that by recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of a united Israel, that there's at least the possibility that the Palestinians could eventually live as equal citizens of a united Israel. My feeling is that they're living under a functional apartheid. There's no hope at all of getting their own separate country. So why not give them equal rights within a united Israel? So I know that's not Trump's intention. I know it's very, you know, he's supporting the Orthodox, but it's just my hope that, you know, perhaps this can, you know, lead to something good out of something that was not intended to be that.
Peter, thank you very much. And we'll talk about this more when former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak comes on later in the program today. Karen, certainly what Peter raises in a very gentle way is the idea of a one-state solution that would probably destroy Israel as a Jewish state, because if he says a united Israel where Palestinians have equal voting rights, then by the math of the demographics of Israel as it exists today, including, you know, the disputed territories, Palestinians would soon be a majority, or if not a majority, have a very, very strong voice in the way Israel is run. And that is not a one-state solution that's acceptable to Israeli Jews. There's another whole kind of one-state solution that has the Palestinians not having their own state, but also not having those equal voting rights in national elections. And, you know, those two different versions of politics are a good indication of why it's such a difficult situation from all sides over there. I think Trump is after something else, and that is almost what he's after with North Korea, that by being tough on things that he considers non-negotiable, like in the case of North Korea, denuclearization, however they define that, in the case of Israel, taking the question of part of Israel, but part of Jerusalem being the Israeli capital, off the table, because it becomes a fait accompli it sets a baseline for negotiating with the Palestinians. And then hopefully, I think, according to Trump's people, that makes it easier in a certain respect because that bottom line is defined to come to yes. But I'm curious if you see it in those terms.
Well, I think that is certainly the president's philosophy, and it is certainly his hope, and it has paid off some very early tentative, as you said, dividends in with North Korea. I think that is also his hope in pulling out of the Iran deal, which he did last week, that essentially by a show of toughness and firmness that you can sort of move people off some issues and on to others. And it remains to be seen if this is the way it plays out.
In another article of yours over the last few days, you wrote that Trump has given a new political cachet to criminals, that his cries of witch hunt and his pardoning of Joe Arpaio, that sheriff in Arizona who's anti-immigration but was defying a court order and was convicted on that basis, have bestowed a, quote, martyrhood on criminals. And you point out that Mike Flynn, of all people, has become a big attraction on the campaign trail. That'll surprise a lot of listeners. Can you explain it?
Yes. Both Mike Flynn and Joe Arpaio, who's running for the Senate, but he's also showing up at fundraisers for other candidates. Essentially, they have, the president continues to complain about Mike Flynn's treatment. And so all of a sudden, they are becoming big draws in some areas, in places like Montana, where, you know, people are willing to donate to a candidate so to get their picture taken with Mike Flynn. It's a pretty extraordinary phenomenon that we see going on here. There was also the spectacle last week of Vice President Pence showing up in Arizona and hailing Joe Arpaio as a, you know, great defender and believer in law and order. We did see, however, in West Virginia last week, Don Blankenship, the former coal baron, had tried this strategy as well. I mean, he is fresh out of prison. And I think it was largely a very muscular intervention by Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell that kind of knocked him into third place.
Let's take another call. And here's Lou on Staten Island on John Kelly's comment about immigrants. Lou, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning to your guests. Mr. General Kelly's remark is not just offensive, but in a deeper sense, it is saddening. Saddening because these are people who, when they were in need, their relatives had people open their hearts and their minds to them and their resources as well. When the Irish came, they came barefooted with valises. Today we refer to them as suitcases with nothing in it but just one check and a flip-flop. Today, they have managed to integrate to help develop this country to where it is now, and he is making this kind of remark. It makes me sad that people who are once in need and got help from other people would rise today to make this kind of remark. But I think this is where the country is heading now, and the tragedy is that it's going to go on for the next 10, 11 years. Even though it will come to an end, but the damage done will take a lot of time to heal. But these people have to remember that this country was built by people who had nothing other than their desire to build something. And it is really saddening as to how it is going on in this country because of the kind of leadership we now have.
Lou, thank you so much. And Karen, to Lou's point, we have a request from a listener to speak about another comment that Kelly made on separating immigrant children from their parents. Are you familiar with that?
I know that he has argued for doing that and saying that that would discourage more immigrants from coming over to this country, which I think is a pretty horrifying sight to see.
And I think that there was a – I know Rachel Maddow last week pointed out the irony of Melania Trump coming out with some remarks about what her – policy interests are as First Lady and having a lot to do with children, And then on the same day, within an hour or so of that, Trump announcing that there would be this policy now of if people cross the border illegally and they were adults with children, the children would be separated from the parents while their cases were processed. So there was the First Lady announcing her interest in the sanctity and safety and well-being of children, and then her husband's administration announcing a short time later that their big new policy was going to be to separate children from their parents if they crossed the border illegally.
Although I must say, and I know there has been some criticism of Melania Trump and suggestions that this is hypocritical on her part, I say more power to her for standing up and speaking. And as she herself has said, especially on things like online bullying, of course everyone thinks immediately about the worst possible example of online bullying who happened to be sitting in the front row in the Rose Garden in her announcement. I just think that, you know, the more the First Lady should speak up on these issues. And if her husband's policies of his administration are going in a different way, then the fact that she is speaking up on them only serves to accentuate this disparity even more.
In fact, you put it in slightly pithier terms in your column the other day. You said Melania Trump is trolling Donald Trump. What did you mean by that?
I think, you know, again, with this Rose Garden ceremony of her announcing her Be Best initiative, with him sitting right there in the front row, she knew exactly what the commentary about all of this was going to be. So, and she is also, by the way, given all of the scandals that are going on with, you know, porn stars and centerfolds, I mean, she is like the one person that the president cannot afford to criticize here. I mean, her approval ratings have gone up dramatically in polls recently, and they are much, much higher than his.
As she swats away his hand when he tries to hold it right at public events. I want to play one more clip of White House Chief of Staff John Kelly in his NPR interview, in which he said something that seemed to take a different position from the official administration one on some immigrants. As you know, as many of our listeners know, many people from certain countries have been here for many, many years under the status known as Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. And this is usually granted to people after there's a big natural disaster in their country, if they were already here. So the Haitians who were already here before the big earthquake there a few years ago, or people from Central America who were already here before some huge hurricanes took place in those countries, have been given temporary protected status. And usually administrations have kind of allowed that to lapse into a kind of de facto permanent status, because it just gets renewed for those individuals who had already been here year after year in many cases. And so last week, just as this caravan of people fleeing current problems in Honduras was reaching the U.S. border, the Trump administration announced, in what seemed especially cruel considering the current troubles down there, that they would be ending temporary protected status for this large group of many thousands of Hondurans who have been here for 20 years, right? So these people are not young primarily and have been living here for 20 years. And suddenly, we're going to ship them back into the current troubles of Honduras. Well, surprisingly for an immigration hawk like John Kelly, he said this about that in his NPR interview.
I think we should fold all of the TPS people that have been here for a considerable period of time and find a way for them to be a path to citizenship.
A path to citizenship?
Yep.
Rather than sent home?
Well, they were in a legal status under TPS. You take the Central Americans, they've all been here 20-plus years. I mean, if you really start looking at, you know, you've been here 20 years, what have you done with your life? Well, I've married an American guy, and I have three children, and I've worked, and I've gotten a degree, or I'm a brick mason or something like that.
John Kelly last week. Did that surprise you, Karen? Did you hear that clip? I'm surprised that didn't make more news when he said it on NPR. It certainly made my ears perk up because it seems to go against the official policy of now wanting to deport these TPS Hondurans back to Honduras. Do you think there's a meaningful discussion within the administration about this?
Well, I certainly would hope so. And this is consistent with what General Kelly had said about assimilation. I mean, these people have, for all intents and purposes, except for, you know, that document that makes them a citizen, they have become Americans.
I'm going to take another call. And here's somebody who wants to talk about Britt Hume. Lloyd in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lloyd.
Hi, and good morning to both of you. Yeah, there's a quick comment. It's rather, I find it so hypocritical of Britt Hume to be taking the position he's taking now, that is with Fox on the leaks. When he was White House correspondent for ABC, he benefited from leaks.
Karen, fair enough, because all the major national Washington reporters benefit from leaks at one point or another.
And again, the leaks are motivated for all kinds of reasons. Sometimes for policy disagreements within an administration. Sometimes for, you know, because somebody has a grudge against somebody else and they're trying to weaken them internally. It is incumbent upon a reporter who gets a leak to be familiar with the source, even if the reporter cannot reveal it, to do the very best this reporter can to confirm this leak through other sources. Often, unfortunately, they will turn out to be not willing to give their names either. But Britt was an extremely good White House reporter, and I'm sure he got his share of leaks or more. And, you know, again, I think probably vetted them, handled them professionally.
Before you go, let's touch briefly on the Russia investigation. Is it this, is it this Thursday that's the one-year anniversary of the appointment of Mueller, the 17th?
It is this week, yes.
And I think Trump has said that by that anniversary date, he's going to announce whether he will voluntarily sit for an interview with the Mueller team. Are they signaling the answer yet?
No. And I think the president has made many, many comments about this, about his eagerness to do this, that are directly at odds with what his lawyers would like to see. Just having watched these kinds of negotiations during in 1998, during the impeachment, independent counsel investigation that led to the impeachment of Bill Clinton, these are very, very complicated negotiations. They will probably involve, you know, first and foremost, setting a time limit on the amount of time the president's willing to go in for this. I would be very surprised if we see this all wrapped up within days or probably even weeks.
And just to put a capper on this segment, you wrote last week in your column that Michael Cohen is the Swiss Army knife of political fixers, an all-purpose tool to have at hand for just about any situation. The chief of AT&T, the company that paid Cohen, one of the companies that paid Cohen a lot of money, $600,000 in their case, called hiring him a big mistake on Friday. Now that these clients of his are being revealed from once his friend Donald Trump was elected president, what have we actually learned from this?
Well, we have learned primarily, we don't know if there's anything illegal in here. We don't know if there were any quid pro quos. We don't really know if where the money went. We don't know if there was any kind of misrepresentations to the banks in this. But what we do know is that the ecosystem of the swamp in Washington is alive and well and thriving.
And there we leave it with Washington Post columnist Karen Tumulty. Starting us off for this week, Karen, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.